Hello and welcome to the Prospect Blueprint. This one is for baseball prospects everywhere. For those of you who feel that sticking your son in the middle of the infield is the fastest ticket to the next level, whatever that next level might be, guess again. For those of you who think travel ball is the ideal team format to get you to the next level, wait until you hear this man's story. What happened in 1963 in the annals of travel baseball will blow you away. He should know he was there. Today's special guest is one of only 31 players in baseball history whose career spanned four decades. He has played with the Minnesota Twins, New York Yankees, Baltimore Orioles twice, my team, the Cleveland Indians, when they were the Indians in 87, the Los Angeles Dodgers, and the Milwaukee Brewers. He also spent 14 years as the pre- and post-game voice of the Baltimore Orioles. He is Rick Dempsey. Rick, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Kelly. Nice to be here with you today.
A pleasure. And I brought my Baltimore Orioles hat.
Okay. Now you're trying to make me feel bad because I'm not there right now. I haven't been there for a couple of years. Well, but I still wish the best for that that ball club. My heart is there with them, although I am a fan of baseball everywhere. And boy, oh boy, there's a lot of changes in the game that have really caused quite a wave.
And what we're going to get into that here in a minute. Now, I just want to tell you that my high school team, we had the exact same colors as the Baltimore Orioles. And Lord knows they kicked the bejesus out of the Cleveland Indians for years. And so I never really got accustomed to wearing that orange and black. But now I look at it in a different way. Those were some hellacious ball clubs. Well, take us back to 1963. You played on a special club with special talent. You played for a coach who had a special talent as well. Save that for last. You're little Rick Dempsey. It's 1963. Tell us about the team, how you got on, and save the incredible backstory of what was going on behind the scenes at the end of this. Go for it.
Well, I played for the Canoga Park Woodland Hills Pony League team. We were Canoga Park Woodland Hills Little League team for a while too, which we always had good players in. At least I thought we had great players. Never considered myself one of the best players at all on my team. I just had guys that were bigger and stronger all the time. But during that Pony League baseball season there in the San Fernando Valley, I remember the day that the season was coming to an end, the last game for all the teams, and they were going to vote the all-star team. Well, they were only going to take like 12 or 13 guys. I think it was 13. And after 12 guys, I hadn't been chosen yet. Finally, my name came up. I had tears in my eyes. I wanted to make that team so bad. And finally, my name was called, and I was the last player voted to that all-star team. Of course, I was the youngest one and didn't get to play a whole lot, but I had a lot of good friends who did. And, you know, back in those days, it really didn't matter. We just wanted to win every tournament. We wanted to go to Washington, Jefferson, Pennsylvania and play in the World Series. Of Pony League World Series. At the same time, our Canoga Park Woodland Hills All-Star team was playing in the Little League World Series in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. So, yeah, they ended up winning, and we ended up losing on the last game. It was double elimination there in Washington, Jefferson, Pennsylvania. But we got to that last game, and we had a chance to win it, but it didn't turn out well for us. Evansville, Indiana was the one that took the championship that year. But we all had a great year. We flew back to Los Angeles, and we were honored at Dodger Stadium, which was the first time I ever saw a major league game. It was incredible. And that's where I knew when I was 8 years old that I wanted to play Major League Baseball. But after seeing the Dodgers on that day, that's when I knew I locked in that I would do anything and everything I could to be a Major League Baseball player. But there was one difference during that season that made it really special for a lot of people was the manager of our Pony League World Series team robbed the bank in every single city that we played our all-star games in, and none of us ever knew it. It was he was part of a famous bank robbing duo called the Mutt and Jeff Bankers. So if you go on and Google 1963 Mutt and Jeff Bank Robbers, you'll see the picture of our Pony League team that is right there with him at the same time. We love the guy. I mean, we never knew that he was into robbing banks with another accomplice that we never saw. But man, what a finish to the season when we all found out that he had finally gotten caught after we lost our last tournament. But it's a crazy story. I just did a documentary on it a couple of days ago. Mark Wahlberg's company has come out here to a lot of our houses and interviewed all of us. And they're still in the process of doing so. They've got about half the team to go yet. They're up in San Francisco right now as we speak, getting ready to put this documentary together.
Yeah, it's amazing. And there is a film planned as well. And that'll come out probably in a couple of years. It takes a while to put that together. And Robert Downey Jr. is slated to be in that as well. You probably knew that. Now, it's called Caught Stealing, and which is an unbelievable title. And who named it that?
Well, it was my wife, actually. We were talking about it at home here many years ago when we felt like, well, maybe we might get a movie out of this. We've all been trying to. We never thought of a documentary, but Randy Cohen, Bruce Davis, and myself, who were the original guys to really get this thing rocking and rolling, were thinking that somehow we could get a movie producer in Hollywood somewhere interested in this story about these Pony League players and the manager that robbed all these banks. So we got the ball rolling, but just through the years, it got difficult. Quite a few motion picture, different companies, Columbia, Warner Brothers, you name it. I had three or four of them myself who bought the rights, and it never really happened. So I put it off on the side for a while and just continued my own personal career. A very good and dear friend of mine who is an actor, Jonathan Schreck, he wrote a little script for this movie and started to present it around Hollywood. And finally, we got some interest, from Mark Wahlberg and his company and his development company to at least do this documentary. And from there, who knows what will happen? I'm afraid to say, yeah, we're going to have a movie produced about this this baseball team and the bank robbers. But I don't want to jinx myself. I'm just going to let it go as it is right now. And we'll see what the big boys do with it.
You know, it's strange because I know three people attached to the project just through happenstance, which is, so we'll keep our fingers crossed, but I think it looks pretty good right now. Now let's talk about you and some of your playing career and specifically about catching. And first, who were your favorite catchers growing up? I'd love to know. I could guess.
Well, who were they? Number one has to be Johnny Bench. You know, he was the biggest name in baseball when I was in. He was catching for the Cincinnati Reds for his entire career. That's the guy that everybody talked about all the time. So I watched every possible game I could watch with Johnny Bench, and I said, someday I want to be just like him. You know, I was already in the major leagues at that time anyway, but to watch somebody that got so much notoriety, it was special. And I met Johnny at spring training in a couple of games that we played against him. I loved the guy. He had everything that you would want from a catcher. He was able to throw. He was able to hit with power. You know, those hit with power was the one thing that I didn't have at that point of my career. But I just watched everything that he did. And Sparky Anderson was his coach, and Sparky lived in my neighborhood. I had a chance to talk to him about Johnny Bench and a lot of things that John did and everything. And I just kind of emulated him until finally I kind of took off on my own. I started, you know, doing some things that were really good. You know, a catcher has to be very cognizant of all the things that pitchers want to do during the course of ball games. And I learned that you've got to spend a lot of time with your pitching staff. It's like having 13 wives on one team. You've got to be there with them all the time, and you don't want anybody else fooling around with your pitcher. So you spend a lot of extra time down in the bullpen watching them. And the most important thing about working with a pitcher in the bullpen is his release point. If he's got some kind of a funky windup, but he's got a great release point, don't mess with him. Don't say anything to him, because where you release that ball, where it can get over the plate, that's the most important part of pitching, is the release point. And so I was fortunate to catch 16 Cy Young Award winners at some time or another during the course of my career. I spent, as you know, 24 seasons in the major leagues, 27 years in pro ball overall. And, you know, I talked to them. I started off with Jim Cott with the Minnesota Twins, and Dean Chance, were those two guys right there. I just talked to them all the time. You know, what makes you love a catcher? How he receives, how he sets up, what is it? And I picked up little things from great pitchers like that. I went to the New York Yankees, and they had Catfish Hunter and George Doc Medich, and just a lot of great pitchers came out of that organization. Mel Stottlemyre came out of that organization at those times. And I had the advantage of talking to Yogi Berra before he passed away, and learning from Yogi with Whitey Ford there all the time was invaluable to me. But I couldn't wait to get to the ballpark every day and talk to all these Yankee greats. Well, I got myself in a little trouble later on when George Steinbrenner was the owner of the Yankees, even though George and I had a great relationship for the entire time I was a Yankee, and even afterwards. I ended up getting in a fight with one of the players as we were going down the stretch. Actually, the Baltimore Orioles and the Yankees were tied 3 games to go in the season. We finished up in Cleveland. We beat your boys 3 times in a row. We're on our way to Milwaukee, and one of the other players, he didn't like being teased by Thurman Munson and Bobby Mercer because they teased him and told him he was the third string catcher. Well, who's the second string catcher? Rick Dempsey. That guy, he can't, you know, he can't do. Well, he got a little, for some reason, he wouldn't aggravate Bobby Mercer and Thurman Munson, because those were the big boys on our team. But he came down. Long story short, he ended up stabbing me in the chest with a fork. We almost had a fight on a flight where there was regular people sitting in the back and the players were sitting up front. It got delayed till we got to the Hotel Pfister in Milwaukee. I ran off the bus. He was screaming at me. He's a pretty big boy. He's about 6'3", about 235, 240 at the time. I was weighing in at a very healthy 165 pounds. And so Bobby Mercer came to me in the lobby and grabbed me by the elbow. And he says, "Demps, come on, let's put it to rest. We got a big series here against Milwaukee. We're tied with Baltimore. We need to win these games." And he couldn't get the words out quick enough that this player grabbed me by the other arm and whipped me around and said, "What's it going to be, street fighting or boxing gloves?" Well, I hit him 3 times and knocked him out. He was laying there on the floor and everybody else started to grab me. But I was in such a frantic situation, I just started hitting everybody because I didn't want him to get up, because I know this guy could break me in half. So I ended up stepping on Bobby Mercer's hand and broke his finger, and he couldn't play in the last 3 games. Fly ball to right center field. Lou Piniella couldn't catch it. We ended up losing 1 game in Milwaukee. The Orioles swept their last series. They won the series. George Steinbrenner was livid. He says, "I want to see those guys in my office day after the season's over when you get back." So I heard him take the other guy in. He yelled and screamed at him and said, "You'll never wear the Yankee pinstripes again. Go get your stuff and get out of here." I was crying because I loved the Yankees at that time. I had family on my wife's side who I loved, all of them. My Uncle Sonny was the head of the Yonkers Trotters track. So anyway, I had all those connections, and I was just heartbroken. I was going to hear George Steinbrenner tell me that I was out, not going to be a Yankee anymore. Well, he called me in and he goes, "Rick, I want you to know something. Thurman just called me on the phone and told me it wasn't your fault, that, you know, really you did what you had to do, blah, blah, blah. But he wasn't happy with the fact that, I put the best player on our team on the disabled list." And,
yeah.
But he said, before I left the office, he says, "I'm probably going to have to get rid of you sometime or another. Not now, but I'm proud of you."
And there you go.
Oh, my God. I, you know, You know, one of the most notorious owners in the baseball was telling me that he was proud of me. So he ended up the next year trading me to the Baltimore Orioles. And that's really where I got my biggest start in Major League Baseball. I got to play every day for Earl Weaver. Man, he was one tough guy to get along with, but I don't think I ever would have wanted to play for anybody else. He was just the best manager, hands down, for so many years. That's what made that Baltimore team a great organization, because he managed with his eyes. He didn't manage with his heart. He just, you know, he's one of those kind of guys that if your name wasn't in that lineup, that it didn't mean you weren't going to play in that game at some time or another. He had a lot of the analytical approach that they look for today. He would write things down and he would always inform me how I should pitch certain guys and how I should handle Jim Palmer and the rest of the great pitchers that I had a chance to handle. He was an incredible manager, but one tough guy. We had a lot of fights that were a lot worse than Palmer and him ever had.
Sure.
But he helped me to be a good player for a long time.
Well, you know, you mentioned Johnny Bench and how ironic that he was named Johnny Bench because he spent almost no time on one, right?
Absolutely. Right? He was too good a player. You could be
a player. Now, I almost moved on Sparky Anderson Street. We were about to close on a house. We backed out 3 days before it closed. I primarily wanted to live there because Sparky Anderson was six doors down and I had twin baby boys. I said, you're going to learn from Sparky freaking Anderson, right?
Yeah.
So let's get into the catching game. Now, when you went to Baltimore, I'm just guessing that maybe Andy Etchebarren was over there, but I had his baseball card. I have all your baseball cards too. Who doesn't, right? Who collected back in the day?
You couldn't possibly have all of mine. I've got about 500.
Well, let me ask you a question though, because you span so many eras. What's the difference between today's catchers and those of your era who are arguably superior defensively and likely played a role in the longevity and effectiveness of the hurlers of that day? They knew how to catch properly. Pitchers threw less pitches, but they threw more. Well, go ahead and you explain.
Well, Kelly, the game has become an offensive position, and that's what the biggest difference in it is right now. When I came into the game, you had to be a good defensive catcher first before they even cared about you hitting the ball. You had to work. You had to be able to handle guys, know what pitches to throw. They depended on the catcher to call the game back there. So I depended on communicating with these guys almost everything that they did once they got to the ballpark. I would talk to them for hours how they liked to pitch certain guys. And when you talk to a guy like Catfish Hunter or Jim Cott or something, they knew exactly how their approach was going to be. Now, these guys were the best of the best. And by talking to them and learning what they like to do during the course of the game, I learned how to handle a lot of good young pitchers that came along in my career. And it just kind of kept carrying over because the way I conditioned myself, I thought was probably the top that I'd ever heard of. Now, there was a wide receiver for the San Francisco 49ers, Rice, that used to work out sort of like I did. He ran mountain roads, fire break roads. I did that too for, 7 miles. And then my first week of workout, and I never stopped working out. When it came home in the wintertime, the day after I unpacked, I was starting my winter workout. It was what I called a tone down from the season, although it was more work then than any other point in the year. Run my 7 miles in times, 6 times 7, 42-minute a workout there. The next day was repeat quarters, 4 miles of repeat quarters in times. The next day, 7 miles again. The next day, 3 miles of repeat half laps, which 220s. So that I had my sprint workout in. And at the same time, finishing up the week with another 7 mile run and then working out at the same time, building up my strength and building up the balls of my feet, I thought were very important for a catcher. His legs have to be really, really strong if you're going to catch long and deep into a career. I worked on the balls of my feet so that just like a guard in basketball or even a person, a ballet artist, you had to have strong feet so you could move quick, stay low, flexibility. I stretched, I did all that kind of stay low in the strike zone, give good low targets, you know, watch a pitcher throw when you're working with him, however big his curveball or slider is. If it's 2 feet of a curveball or 6 inches of a slider, that's exactly where you would give him the target in the low part of the zone. It might be out of the zone when you put it. It might only be a couple inches off the ground, but that's where you wanted that ball to hit your glove because it went right through the corner of the strike zone. It's precision. It's really not pitching practice. It's precision practice is what it is. And you had to be so precise back in those days. That's what kept me in Major League Baseball for so long, is that I was very precise with all of the pitchers that I faced. And I spent a lot of time with new guys come to the ball club. They were the first ones that I wanted to see because I knew the older guys and I could handle them. And I knew what they wanted from me, being able to call the right pitch for them at the right time and to know them, put the responsibility on them, but myself at the same time at being able to handle young guys and using the right kind of principles behind home plate that get those guys deep into ball games and then turn it over to the bullpen if they had to or finish it out. So there's really a lot more that the players of today's game don't do. If you can put the catcher's equipment on by yourself and you can hit the ball out of the ballpark, you're going to get a chance to catch. In my day, that didn't happen. You better know how to help a pitcher get deep into ball games. And when he was asked you a question, you better have the right answer. If he keeps missing outside, usually the answer from me was make a better turn. Get that front shoulder turned a few more inches is a few more feet when it comes to home plate. Sometimes you have to speed them up. They're too slow. You got to speed them up. Or when they're trying to work too fast, you have to slow them back down. But, you know, sometimes you'd see a pitcher's elbow get down like this. They think you got to say, get your elbow up and get on top of the ball. There's only three or four things you can say. I couldn't tell them how to hold their curveball. That's the pitching coach's job. Talking about, you know, those kind of mechanical things, I stayed away from that. During the course of the game, it was pretty basic and simple. But learning how to help certain guys that weren't as talented as the Jim Palmers or guys or Mike Flanagan's that I caught, you learned how to use use things to your advantage. Whenever a hitter comes up, and I know this from experience, when you're thinking more than one thought, the one thought like a George Brett, just see the ball and hit the ball, okay? But when you put two thoughts in a hitter's mind, oh, what is he going to throw me, a fastball or curveball? All I had to do to my pitchers is shake my head. If I went like this, I wanted them to shake no. If I went like this, I wanted them to shake yes. And that way you throw a thought in a hitter's mind, what's he going to do to me now? Hard left-hander, throwing against a left-handed hitter, a good left-handed hitter. You get ahead two strikes and no balls and you shake your head no. And the pitcher shakes his head no, you throw one up under his chin, 98 miles an hour. He's going to remember when you shake your head no on the next pitch, and then he thinks he's going to get it again, and you throw that slider down the middle with nothing on it, and he takes it for strike three. So, I mean, you use things to your advantage, and I don't see that anymore. I don't see players working on the pickoff plays that they should be working on. There's 27 outs in most every single ball game that doesn't get delayed or extra innings, and you've got to get 27 outs, and sometimes picking those players off the bases really helps the pitcher get out of a lot of trouble. One guy I absolutely love, and he didn't start off too well in his major league career, was Steve Stone. He was a pretty good pitcher for the White Sox. He was a sub 500 pitcher, but he came to me, and I'll never forget the first start that we had. He went into the ninth inning of a ball game, the top of the ninth in Baltimore, and he had a runner on third base and less than two outs. I had one out. And I called for him with a two strike and no ball situation. I called for him to throw a curveball in the dirt. And he stepped off the mound and he shook his head. No, I'm not going to do it. And so I ran to the mound. I said to him, Steve, what's the matter? He goes, I'm not throwing this curveball in the dirt and let that run score down at third base. And I started laughing at him. I said, hey, listen, bud, you don't have a good enough curveball to throw it by me. But I know you can get this guy out. You've got to learn to pitch out of the strike zone when you're ahead with vulnerable hitters. Some guys, we know they're going to take those pitches, but a lot of guys are iffy. If you throw it close enough, they're going to swing at it. And there is no percentage, absolutely zero. Today in the game, two strikes and no balls, you're going to get a high fastball 99% of the time. They think that that's the pitch they're going to get you out with the most. I got news for them. I know a good curveball in the dirt never, ever gets hit. And so yeah. I blocked the curveball for him. Steve got out of the inning. That year, he was incredible. He was voted the Cy Young Award winner of the American League. He won 25 games and lost seven. 25-7. He'd never pitched that much in his life in one season, but he learned something about baseball and he learned how to pitch out of the strike zone when he had hitters when he was ahead in the count, they were behind in the count. So there's a lot of things you pick up through the years that can help young pitchers, even if they're not that great, you can help them as long as they can throw the ball over the plate. The velocity is the worst thing you should ever worry about. Doesn't have to throw 99. You can see that now that pitch gets hit quite often in the major leagues today. Maybe it's because they've sped up the gun a little bit and they've added like 2 or 3 miles per hour to every pitcher's fastball. But
yeah.
Aside of that, there's just things like that. And executing a perfect pickoff play with a guy on third base, it just, it really gives the team a lift. And when you work on things like that nonstop, you're going to be successful at the major league level. And the catching is so much fun. You're involved in every single play. And when you get locked in about how to handle and read hitters, who's the pull hitter, who's the spray hitter, who uses the whole field, who doesn't? Boy, you get those pull hitters up there. Just go ahead and throw them the fastball on the inside corner. They pull it foul. Line drive, vicious line drive, scares the hell out of everybody. But you let him do that twice, and then you pull the string on him down with a curveball on the outside corner or in the dirt, and they swing at it, and they go sit down. So you remember those things through the years, And all pitchers, you can't make it with just two pitches at the major league level. You've got to have an off-speed pitch if you're going to be a starter. You might be able to get a guy out of the bullpen once in a while that comes in, and it was a two-pitch guy, fastball, slider, or something like that. You might get away with that for an inning or so. But you better have a good off-speed pitch along with your fastball and your curveball or slider and everything if you're going to be a good starter in the game at any point of my career or their career today.
Are there any catchers out there right now that you would consider an elite catcher other than maybe Yadier Molina?
Molina came from my era, he was a young guy, but he was there long before I retired. And, he calls a hell of a game. He had a lot of savvy. The St. Louis Cardinals are one of those organizations like the Baltimore Orioles were for a long time. They were disciplined and they taught him discipline. And I know later on in his career, he got to the point where he was slapping at some balls like his brothers did, who were catchers at the major league level. I don't think any of them were as good as he was. But, he was a pretty solid defensive guy. No doubt he's going to be a Hall of Famer because he made himself a better hitter at the major league level than I did. That was for sure. But he's a lock, that guy right there, and one of the best catchers that ever put the uniform on.
Yeah. Now, one thing that I've noticed, and we have about 5 more minutes, is that there are a lot of pitching coaches and there's a lot of batting coaches, but there aren't that many catching coaches out there. Now, shout out to a guy by the name of David Klein out in Northern California with the Legends Baseball Camps. He's an exception to the rule. But why do you think that is? Because here in our area, in Thousand Oaks, Westlake, Newbury Park, there's maybe, I mean, I couldn't name you a single catching coach.
Well, nor could I, because I think all the really good catching coaches, and the one, Cal Ripken Sr., was the guy who took me, and he impressed upon me the discipline I needed to have with the Baltimore Orioles. He was a great catching coach. You don't see it anymore because the teams will hire guys that they think know the game, but you have to have spent some time behind home plate. You have to have spent some time in the bullpen with all the pitchers that every team has to work with. And when one guy's having trouble, you've got to go. It's up to you. If you're the regular catcher, it's up to you to get into that bullpen with him and help him. Because when he gets two or three people on his side that are trying to make him a better pitcher and get him deep into ballgames and help the team win, he really is invaluable. And you don't see that in the game anymore today. You just don't have. They're bringing in guys that have never had any experience at handling a major league pitching staff, and that just can't happen. I know the computers are good and they give you all the numbers, Kel, but really, computers and players, the best players under tough game situations will make adjustments when they've made a few outs and they come up and they look for pitches and things. But computers cannot make adjustments. And you've got to know how to play the game too. When you want a guy to hit the ball to the right side, you got to know who you can make do that. You don't want guys, hitting the ball to the right side when you got a man at second, nobody out. It puts him in scoring position and the game is on the line. You got to be able to block balls behind home plate because there is no event in playoff the World Series that is more serious than a catcher missing a ball or a pitcher throwing wild pitches. And a lot of those wild pitches in playoff and World Series have cost teams huge in playoffs and World Series situations. And it's been one of the determining factors for quite a few of these last years that I haven't been around the game anymore. But I watch on television. I mean, how many games do you see in playoff and World Series where it's more than a one or a two run game? It just doesn't happen very often. I'd probably say 70 to 80% of those games are all determined by one or two runs. You don't want to be the catcher that's always missing that ball and going to the backstop and giving the advantage to the opposing team, because you're not going to win very much when you see that.
Yeah, one thing I did want to interject, you talked about World Series. You know a little bit about World Series. You've been in a few, and you were the MVP in one in 1983 as well.
Absolutely. Blind squirrel finds an acorn every now and then, Bill.
I like that one. Well, listen, there's so much to talk about. I mean, you come from the era that I love. What do you say we do one more at a later date?
Absolutely. Let's do it. I love talking baseball, and you're a guy who knows the game pretty well and wants to know how it's orchestrated and how you make winning teams. I'm there with you, brother.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Well, folks, that is none other than Mr. Rick Dempsey. What he has seen, arguably, in Major League's best areas can only be described as truly privileged. And we're privileged to have him on board with us tonight. Rick, thanks for suiting up for us.
Thank you very much, Kel. I look forward to talking to you again.
Well, that's it, folks. Our official launch of the podcast is coming up soon. It's been more than a year in the making, I know that, but what can I tell you? Remember, play hard, study hard, and eat your spinach. Have a great summer. For the Prospect Blueprint, I'm Kelly Kleiman. We'll see you soon.